Welcome to the Beyond Addiction Show with Josh King. This program is designed to help those who are affected by substance use. Whether you are using, trying to stop, or a loved one who wants to help, there are many effective resources, and together we'll explore them and bring you hope. Now, here is your host, Dr. Josh King.
Hello and welcome back to the show. Today on the show, we are going to play an interview with Dr. Mark Lewis, who joined us to discuss his learning theory of substance use disorders, which he believes, and I honestly agree with him, is where we're moving in the model of understanding substance use disorders. You may remember, if you listened to the Maya Salovitz episode, substance use disorders, addiction, a learning disability. She's saying something very similar to what he's saying. He's coming at it from another angle. So this really seems to be the place that the world is moving in the understanding of, all right, how do we think about substance use disorders? So I think it's a really important and helpful interview, and I'm looking forward to everyone hearing it. Next week, we are going to be talking live with Dr. David Fagan, a pediatrician who has done a lot of research and work on guiding policy around e-cigarettes all around the country. These things are big, big business. We see it all the time here at the Center for Motivation and Change. People coming in, they have e-cigarettes, they're smoking them all the time. They're smoking them compulsively. And it's really, really interesting. And there are all these myths about what they are, if they're healthy, if they're good for you. And so he's going to help us really get a lot of the facts about e-cigarettes and bust some myths about them and start to discuss some policy points that he has been pushing and he and other people have been pushing around the country. And I think that that's important. I'd also like to thank everyone who went online and rated this show. Sadly, we had significantly less than the 50 ratings I asked for. Did get some, so thank you everybody who did it. But I also got a lot of people saying, I actually don't know how to rate a show. So if you have an iPhone, the way to rate it is you go into the podcasts app and you search the Beyond Addiction Show. And when you pull that up, first of all, subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Make sure you just hit that little subscribe button. But as you scroll down through the show page on the podcast app, you scroll down and it's going to say recent podcasts and it's or recent episodes. And then you keep scrolling and you'll see something that says ratings and reviews. And then there's a spot that says tap to rate. And there's 5 stars next to it. Just go over there and hit that 5th star all the way to the right if you think that's what I deserve, and you're done. And it'll say, thank you, saved. So let's see if we can get the ratings bump this week that we didn't quite get last week. And so you all know why I actually care about this and want this ratings bump. The more people that rate the show, that makes it show up in other people's podcast feed. It makes it show up in their recommended podcasts. And the more people that we can get to see this show, we can get more listeners. And the more listeners we get, the more people we help to become informed consumers of treatment. So really, by you checking off those 5 stars, you're not just helping me out, but you're actually helping out anybody who might be interested in finding out this information. We're helping them become more educated consumers of substance use treatment. So please give me that rating. If you think 5 stars, give me them 5 stars. That's what we're looking for. And since we're talking with Dr. Lewis after this about the new theory of substance use disorders, I thought it's probably a helpful thing if we go over some of the older theories of substance use disorder, because I don't know that we've necessarily done that. And specifically, I want to go over the moral model and the disease model, because those are the two most prevalent ideas of substance use and how we think about substance use, and they've guided most treatment throughout history and even today. So we're going to take a little bit of a look at these two models, and we're going to start with the moral model. The moral model has pretty old beginnings. It harkens back to the 1800s, when the temperance movement and groups and people associated with with the temperance movement were coming up in America. And reminder, the temperance movement, the people who started Prohibition, they were not fans of specifically alcohol. And back then, they really viewed addiction as a sin, that you were acting out the base instincts of humanity. Now, that's not everyone who was in the temperance movement actually had that idea, but there were a couple of main characters who really pushed this idea. And so addiction was starting to be looked at as a sinful act, that the issue was the individual, the person themselves. It had nothing to do with the environment that they grew up in or the family structure or their genetic makeup, even though they wouldn't have said genetic makeup. It had to do with a person's character, or more specifically, a defect in their character that led them to have this weakness, this part of them that was not strong enough to hold back the devilish impulses that was addiction, that was alcohol. And so they were giving in to this desire to drink because they had this weakness within them. And so that was really what the moral model was based off of. This idea that you as a person have a character defect. There's something wrong with you. And that is why you are drinking. That is why you are succumbing to substance use, and why other people don't. It's because they are not as sinful as you. They are stronger than you. They have higher moral character and moral fortitude than you do. And you simply don't have that. So that's the problem. It was also the beginning of the abstinence-only movement, which was actually divisive within early temperance. It began with a reverend, Lyman Beecher, who asked people to sign an abstinence pledge. And if they did, they put a T next to their name, marking them as a teetotaler. And that's how that began. And from the beginning of the temperance movement, it just steadily grew in power, in political power, for many years, waxing and waning at different times, but really coming into power in the early 1900s, around 1919 is when Prohibition began. But between 1919 and sometime in the 1930s, over 50% of Americans lived in dry counties or places where you couldn't get alcohol at all. So the idea that people who were drinking, they were doing something that was morally wrong. They did that. That was pervasive around the country. It had been baked into America. This idea, you're doing this, it's because you have a weakness. It's not because of anything else. It's on you. And just an aside, if you have more interest in hearing about some of this history, there's a documentary on it's on Netflix now. It was a PBS documentary and on Prohibition. And like all of those PBS documentaries, they can be long and they can be slow, but there's so much information in this, and you can really get a feel for how this grew into this movement that really put it onto this idea of a moral problem, a moral failing. So you could get a lot more information on this. Well, the impact of this thought process, of this way of thinking on clinicians, is mixed, right? On the plus side, if addiction is due to a moral failing or a character defect, well, those can actually be fixed, right? You might not be able to completely fix a character defect, but if it's around this idea of choice, you can choose to give in, you can choose to do this, well, then you can also make a different choice. And that idea that you can have choice is really, really, really important. And so if a clinician's really holding a moral model, then they should be holding this idea that you have choice. You have the ability to shift. You have the ability to change. On the downside, and there are many, the overwhelming one is that it totally suggests you're the problem. It's you. You're fundamentally flawed. That's the issue. Well, if I'm somebody who's sitting there and I'm struggling with alcohol, and the first thing that somebody is saying to me is, well, you're fundamentally flawed, I'm not going to see that person. So I'm not going to get help. So the help that I might need, I am not going to engage in, because you have to take on this idea that you are fundamentally flawed. That is also not factual, because it's not that way. It's not that cut and dry, and it's not that black and white and simple. There are so many components which bring a person towards substance use. In fact, many of them make perfect sense when you really think about it. It does, and this model doesn't account for any of them. It oversimplifies the problem in a way that ignores so many other factors that are at play. So the idea of the Moore model has been phased out, and for good reason, because it was just not a model that really stood up to scrutiny, and it didn't help. So the next stage of thinking in the moral model was really displaced by this idea of the disease model, which the idea of substance use, especially alcohol use disorders, as a disease. There are moments in it throughout history where it's been thought of as a disease, but this new one really was a major shift in thinking about substance use disorders. And it says that the addiction lies within the person, but not as a character defect or a weakness. It's like any other disease that's out there. It's like cancer, or it's like diabetes. And it should be treated similarly to the way that any other disease or an illness that a person has is treated. So we don't go around and say that a person with cancer, oh my God, look at what they did, that they got cancer. We don't blame their character. We don't say, well, they're just weak. They let the cancer in. We don't blame somebody for getting a disease. And so this new way of looking at it was super, super helpful in making a person who might want treatment but doesn't want to own all of this other baggage that comes along with it, helps them to say, all right, This is where I'm at. I can think about this different. I can maybe enter into some kind of treatment. The disease model goes on to say that addiction isn't really on a continuum. You got it or not. Yet you can't control your substance use or your intake of substances. And that it's a chronic relapsing disease, meaning that you are going to struggle with this forever. It's not going anywhere. You will have it. So this was a major, major step forward in many different ways. First of all, by calling it a disease and having the American Medical Association take it on as a disease, that means that it is now a health issue and a public health issue, not a moral issue. So that meant that we are now going to treat it the way that we treat other diseases, which means that we research it and we come up with evidence-based approaches to deal with it. And we have ways that we talk about it that are much more scientifically based. That's huge. And it took away the shame aspect of this, sorta. Because now, instead of being morally corrupt, you just have this disease forever. So there is some improvement there. I'd rather have a disease that it's like, all right, I've got this and now I have to live with it, versus, oh, no. Like, deep down in my soul, I've got this issue. But being able to shift that kind of shame means that now suddenly we have a lot more people who are going to be willing to engage in treatment. And it also took away some of the tropes that come along with the moral model, like this idea that willpower is how you handle this. Because willpower actually is not a really effective coping skill for dealing with substance use. On the downside, it doesn't hold up to a ton of research when you really start to scrutinize it. And as far as the chronic disease part of this, according to Casa Columbia, the Center for Addiction at Columbia University, 50 to 75% of people don't have it chronically. They do not have it as a chronic disease. So it's hard to see it as this chronic relapsing disease if 50 to 75% of people do not seem to have this for their lifetime. And there's not a lot that you can do to curb cancer behaviorally speaking, right? You can go and you can get these medicines, but there's not a lot that you can do behaviorally to say, oh, I'm going to really like cut back on my cancer today, right? There is a ton that you can do to change and to curb your substance use. So there's a lot more that's there. So why is this important to understand? Well, it's important because when you look through history, a lot of how we look at and treat other people is based on how we think about them. And if we have a model that says that people who are struggling with substances actually have space to change and to get better, and that it's not because that there's something deeply seated wrong with them, but that there is a nuanced reason why they're getting to this point. And that's really where Mark Lewis is going to come in and talk about the new way of thinking about this, which is much more nuanced. But that rather than thinking about it that way, it gives us space when we think about them as people who have space to change, where it's understandable, where they can get better, where they can change things. We suddenly get a much more whole picture of a person, not of a substance, not of an issue, but of a person. And when we have that, it leads to better treatment outcomes, better treatment options, and a far more positive impact on society as a whole. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Dr. Mark Lewis, who's going to help us understand this new, more, much more nuanced version of the learning model of substance use.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Now there's a book for families who are looking to help loved ones. Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change is now available at Amazon.com, available in hardcover, paperback, and on Kindle. Pick up your copy of Beyond Addiction today. If you are a parent or a partner who is seeking guidance in helping a loved one with substance use, be sure to pick up the 20-Minute Guide. This is a terrific resource, and proceeds help the CMC Foundation for Change. Visit the 20MinuteGuide.com. That's 20MinuteGuide.com. CMC Foundation for Change is a new not-for-profit that is all about families helping families and parents helping parents through addiction from those who have been there. Over 111 million family members worldwide are affected in some way by addiction. CMC Foundation for Change helps give these families hope through support, education, and helpful resources. For more information about CMC Foundation for Change, please visit cmcffc.org on the web. That's cmcffc.org. This is the Beyond Addiction Show. If you have a question or comment about our show, be sure to send an email to beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Again, that's beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back, and joining me now is Dr. Mark Lewis. He is a neuroscientist and a professor at Radboud University in the Netherlands. He is the author of Memoirs of an Addicted Brain and his recent book, The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Josh. Nice to be here.
So let's start off with some of your personal history, which I know you've shared before. How did you end up getting into the topic of addiction?
Well, it's kind of a long story. The short form is when I was throughout my 20s, I took a lot of drugs and I was pretty seriously addicted to opiates. I did a lot of crime. I got arrested. I got convicted a couple of times. This is in Canada. So I was a mess. I had to get my life straightened out. And I did that finally around the age of 30. And then having been kicked out of school for some of my excesses, I got back into graduate school in psychology and pursued a master's and then a PhD in psychology, both clinical and research psychology. And then I got a job as a professor. And by then I'd been off drugs for quite a few years, I guess 5 or 6, 7 years by then. And then I had a career. I studied emotion and the brain and child development and child emotional development, emotion regulation, how kids learn to deal with difficult emotions, how they develop their own style of self-regulation and how their personalities kind of take form around those individual differences. And then kind of at the far end of all that, I thought, well, maybe I should think about addiction again after all those years, but think about it as a professional, as a neuroscientist, as a person who is studying it, rather than as a person who's trapped by it. And I started to look at the literature and really learned an awful lot about addiction and the brain, what happens in the brain when people go through addiction. And I got very inspired by that and started writing about it and giving talks and writing both for a lay audience, kind of a pop science vein, but also for professionals, for people in addiction neuroscience and people who are trying to understand it through scholarship and research. And that's the story.
And your background, though, looking online, you can find out so much about a person. Your background is kind of like in Piagetian psychology. So really, your framework of looking at the world is through learning and, sure. I guess, evolution. Yeah?
Uh-huh, yes.
So did that play a big role in looking at addiction?
Yeah, I guess the main thing was in developmental, my job title was essentially as a professor of developmental psychology, and I branched into neuroscience from there. And when child development is your main gig, then you recognize learning as just the fundamental way that people become who they are. There are influences from genetics and other biological factors that might not have to do with learning, but a lot of how the brain evolves and develops, a lot of who we become through in early childhood and then throughout our childhood years, which tends to consolidate in late adolescence, a lot of that happens through learning, which of course is impacted on by context, social context, hardships, difficulties in parenting or in peer interactions, and all societal issues, and all of that stuff impacts very much on how we learn to be who we are. So when I started to understand that the main story for explaining addiction, especially in the U.S. and in Western Europe, the Western world, was to see addiction as a disease, it never made sense to me. And when I looked at the way that scientists, neuroscientists and medical scientists modeled addiction as a brain disease, and they look at all these changes in the brain, and you know the brain is changing in all these ways, and that must mean that it's a pathology. It's like, no, the brain is supposed to change. In developmental psychology, that's the first thing you learn. The brain is an organ of change. So
right. Isn't that the whole idea of plasticity?
Yeah. I mean, neuroplasticity, you know, you see it in anything from stroke victims to, you know, whatever it is. It's a massive way to look at it. But in childhood, just normal development, you see so much change as we internalize experience and develop more and more sophisticated ways of regulating our emotions and regulating our cognitions and becoming who we are.
So in the book Biology of Desire, which is your most recent book, but it's been out for a couple of years now, you're really, you're eschewing older models of addiction, right? You're eschewing the moral model, which was sort of the first model of addiction, and right. The more current disease model of addiction. And you're right. Presenting this third model, the idea of a learning model. Can you explain right. both how you got to that and how your model is different from these previous models?
Yeah, well, to me, the moral model is kind of a non-starter. I mean, I think anyone who's been through addiction or who has intimately known people who've been through addiction recognizes that these are not evil people. We are not evil people. Addiction is not a result of being, you know, an inadequate, self-indulgent, pleasure-seeking, you know, whatever. It's rather something that happens to people through unfortunate circumstances and unfortunate experiences. So the moral model goes out first. And then, you know, you see the disease model, which really became, well, it's gradually developed through the second half of the 20th century, and then it became the brain disease model in the 1990s once the technology enabled us to see more of what was happening in the brain. But still, it's a disease model. And that was kind of advocated as a replacement for the moral model. So, for example, the National Institute on Drug Abuse and various other federal medically oriented organizations would say, no, addicts are not evil people. They're not bad people, but they simply don't have a choice because they have a disease. And so, okay, that was step two. Nice that they've managed to continue to dump the moral model, but we can do a whole lot better than saying, you know, just put addiction in another kind of vague wastebasket category and say it's a disease and try to, you know, leave it at that, because there's so much more to understand about addiction. So, yeah, where I go from there, and I'm not the only one, there are other people in the field. Maya Salovitz comes to mind. There's quite a few others as well who see learning as the primary mechanism by which people develop addictions. And in a nutshell, addiction is a very deeply entrenched habit, a way of regulating your emotions by taking substances or by watching porn or by sex or overeating or binge eating or gambling. There's all kinds of addictions that are not substance related, but this is a habit for self-regulation, for feeling a little bit better in the world. And it's mostly something that people fall into because they have had difficulties in childhood and adolescence, and maybe they didn't have other possibilities as much as available to them as they might have, either because of who they are or because of the kind of environments that they grew up in or because of the difficulties they might have had with parents and peers and school systems and so forth. Well, that's really where the learning model, that's where it lays its that's where it plants its flag, I think.
So you're saying that some of this learning could actually go back to childhood?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Is it like the way that we learn to deal with difficulty? Is it the way that we learn to deal with disappointment and frustration? What kind of things make it, would be predictive factors maybe that could lead to substance use in the future?
Right. Well, it's pretty well known now that adversity in childhood and that adverse childhood experiences has become a way to kind of codify unfortunate events in childhood and adolescence, and they include abuse, which could be physical, emotional, or sexual, neglect, having a depressed parent, having a parent in jail, having a parent who's an alcoholic or an addict, of course, doesn't make life easier for the kid. And if you put these factors together, you see that they strongly predict or correlate with addiction later in life, or not later in life, and starting in adolescence. So we recognize that adversity itself is a mechanism, a motor. Why does it have these impacts? Well, probably because these kinds of experiences leave behind trauma, depression, and anxiety. These are feeling states that are character conditions that make you feel that you don't belong in the world, make you feel uncomfortable, sad, upset, freaked out, helpless. I mean, you know what that feels like. Most of us have experienced some of these feelings, at least for some periods of time. And if you experience a lot of that, you try to find a way out. You try to find a way to make yourself feel better. And addiction is a way to make yourself feel better. So that's how the habit first gets, gets started. And then when circumstances permit, when there's access, when there's some sort of reinforcement from the environment, that habit becomes more and more deeply entrenched. And of course, as we know, it becomes a trap, because something which is very difficult to stop. Nobody doubts that part about addiction. This is not a nice state, and it's pretty hard. It takes a lot of effort to get yourself out of it.
Mm-hmm. And for those people who might be listening and saying, all right, but my kid or I myself did not have trauma as a child. I wasn't physically abused. I didn't have one of those things. No parent of mine was in jail. Right. How would you explain to somebody like that how their early learning might have impacted?
Well, there's variation in everything, especially when you study people and you study child, we study development. There's variation in every variable. That's what they call the variables. But for myself, for example, I mean, my parents were pretty decent. They did the best they could, and I wasn't subjected to anything horrible when I was young. But they did send me to a boarding school in my adolescence, and I got very depressed there. I was like a fish out of water. I was lonely. I was bullied. I had to learn how to fight. And when I came out of there, I was kind of a different person. I was 17 years old, and I was depressed and lonely and didn't really know how to function socially in a very effective way. I happened to end up in Berkeley, California, and it was 1968. And, the streets
were full of some drugs going on there.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, yeah, this looks like it's worth exploring. And that's what I did. I explored it, and it soon became kind of a way of life.
Mm-hmm. So in other words,
it doesn't have to be something horrendous. It can be, for different kids, particular circumstances can have a lasting impact because of who the kid is and what other kinds of resources they have to help them get through.
Right. So everyone's temperament and just the way that they interact with things can be different, right? For you, going to boarding school was really difficult. And for somebody else, that may not have been all that difficult.
Yeah.
Freeing.
So we when we think back, especially on early adolescence, I think everyone has painful memories of what it's like to be, to be humiliated by other kids, to be wearing the wrong shoes, to be singled out, to be rejected or isolated or ostracized. And adolescence is full of these kinds of experiences. And actually, anxiety and depression occur in the lives of most adolescents. I think the rates are between 30 and 50% that adolescents will at some point reach the stage of clinical depression at some point in their adolescence. Now, that's not necessarily going to last for years, but it can be a rough ride for just about anybody. And for some people, that leaves lasting impacts that, take the form of addictions, and then, you're kind of screwed.
Mm-hmm. So there are some people who I think don't like the idea that addiction is a choice. I think that there's a stigma that if it's a choice and you're choosing to do it, then there's like something wrong with you. And then that leads us back into that moral model. What do you say to somebody who's thinking like that?
I think it's a bit simplistic. It presumes that choice is simple. That choice is, you either choose to do something or you choose to do something else. Well, in fact, we make hundreds, maybe thousands of choices throughout the day that are barely conscious. And every time you pull up to a traffic light, if it's an orange light, are you going to go through it or not? Well, it's going to depend on how late you are and what you had for breakfast and whether you're feeling kind of, a little bit defiant or that you're feeling, differently. Context matters, mood matters. So there are so many things that impact on choice that it's not simple. We don't understand choice very well at all, in fact, and most of it is unconscious. The point is that when people experiment with substances, for example, as most people do in adolescence at some point, well, where's the point where choice becomes, this evil, I'm going to choose to be an addict? No, it's not like that. You choose to try something because someone's passing it around at a party or whatever it is, or because, your girlfriend or your boyfriend say, yeah, give it a shot. And one thing leads to another, and these experiences tend to be self-perpetuating and build on themselves. So there isn't a point at which you choose to, behave badly. It's that you fall into patterns of behavior that are that have a life of their own or have a certain amount of momentum of their own.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, to say that there's a dichotomy, it's either a choice or it's a disease, to me, it's just missing most of the interesting part of the story.
It's the nuance of it is totally taken out.
Yeah, exactly.
You also spend a lot of time talking about brain functioning that impacts addiction. Can you give us like the super brief overview of where the brain is coming into it?
Yeah, well, I mean, the brain comes into everything, right? Just everything. So it would be surprising if the brain wasn't a big part of the picture. All learning experiences involve brain changes. the expression is that what fires together wires together. What that means is that when neurons activate one another, you have a pathway of activation from one neuron to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. That's what fires together wires together. Those neurons become more closely interconnected, and that's how patterns in the brain develop. And what that means is that when you, in a simple way, anything that is habitual involves repeating patterns of thought and behavior again and again, it's going to develop stronger synaptic connections, stronger connections between neurons, which are go through synapses, the connections between neurons. And so the brain is definitely going to change. Now, what we have to think about then is the amount of change and the kind of change that you see in the brain. Does it cross a line? Is there a point at which we can say this is not normal change, this is not normal developmental change, this is pathological change? And that's the point at which people have, even those who advocate the disease model, they can't say. They have a very hard time saying, oh, okay, here's this part is normal, but then after it crosses this line, it's not normal anymore. There is no such line. There's too much diversity. There's too much individual difference. You can't specify that this amount or degree or kind of brain change is suddenly worthy of being called the disease, unless it's something like Alzheimer's, Korsakoff syndrome. There are certain brain diseases that we can call disease because you can see very severe organ dysfunction. The brain is no longer, blood isn't getting where it's supposed to go, and so forth. But the kind of change, brain change, you see in addiction, it isn't that kind of change.
Right. It sounds like you're saying that it still fits within the normal range of change that you'd expect if we introduced some brand new instrument into your world that you then started using every day. That would also change your brain in a similar way that a substance that's being introduced would change your brain.
Yeah. One of my kids is doing a lot of piano these days. He's practicing, at least an hour a day now. His brain is definitely changing. The way he organizes his conception of the keyboard and chords and how they relate to each other and counterpoint and harmony, all of that stuff is changing week to week to week, which is how people learn to do something in a skillful and maybe it's important to say in a more automatic way. When skills or habits become more automatic, that means there's less involvement of the prefrontal cortex, the kind of more conscious thinking part of the brain, and more involvement of other brain systems that just kind of take over when you don't have to think about what you're going to do next because you already know what you're going to do next. Well, that applies to whether you're learning an instrument or whether you're learning to shoot heroin. It sounds pretty weird, but if you think about it, taking the same drug every day in the same way every day, spending your day looking for ways to get money, to fund it, to whatever it is, excuse it, to keep yourself safe, all of those things, if they're habitual, if you do the same thing every day, then they become automatic and there's less thinking involved and there's more just habitual action routines that are self-perpetuating. So in that respect, addiction really is just a habit. Unfortunately, it's a habit with pretty nasty outcomes.
Right. And would you say that behavioral addictions like screens and gaming and gambling, would that all fall in the same category?
Yeah, there's a lot of work in that these days, a lot of controversy as well. So whether gaming is an addiction or not, I'm sure there's a lot of pretty emotional argumentation about that one. And I've got a couple of 13-year-olds from my second marriage that make it, we have to control how much time they spend on the screen because it is very attractive. And if we let them, they're gonna play games, for 4 or 5 or 6 hours a day. Mm-hmm. But as it turns out, when you look at brain change and behavioral addictions, you see very similar patterns to substance addictions. For example, in binge eating disorder, There are changes in areas of the prefrontal cortex and an area called the striatum, which is where dopamine, the chemical, a neurochemical called dopamine, people read a lot about that, and reward, is an important player. That looks very similar between eating disorders, especially binge eating disorder, and substance addiction to heroin or methamphetamine. So with porn also, there's been a fair bit of examination. With gambling as well, there's a lot of commonalities in the dopamine system and how it responds to cues that, oh, there's a reward coming up and now I have to really focus, and now I'm really, that's all I care about is this particular reward, whether it's winning, at blackjacks, or whether it's, scoring cocaine. And it's very similar systems are involved.
So, you mentioned before that Maya Salovitz is somebody who has been talking about this same idea. Carl Hart is another one that is talking about this idea of the learning theory of addiction. Maya right. actually was on this show talking about this. Is this, do you think, becoming a movement in the field?
Yeah, I think it is. I think as time goes by, the disease model is coming under more fire than more and more criticism, because it's not very satisfied. You call addiction a disease, and then what? Is there something you can take to make it go away? Is there a drug you can take? Well, no. If it's opioid addiction, then you can take, there's two or three substances you can take that will circumvent withdrawal symptoms. And that's a very, very useful thing, especially for people who are taking heroin, because obviously it prevents a lot of deaths. If they can get the need for opioids satisfied by methadone or by a prescription from a doctor rather than out on the street, they're a lot more likely to stay alive. And that's a very good thing, but it's not a cure. It's not a cure for the attraction or for the tendency to continue to want to take opioids. And there are other drugs like cocaine and methamphetamine for which there are no withdrawal symptoms. There's no physical dependency like there is with opioids. So, how does calling it a disease actually help? And also, when we look at the data and you talk about, evidence-based approaches to the phenomenon, we know that addictions, habitual use of different drugs, have a particular profile. For example, there's a median span of time between when people start to take a certain substance and when they stop. For cocaine, it's 4 years. For cannabis, it's 6 years. For alcohol, it's something like 13 to 15 years. But these are medians, so like an average. They're maybe not all that helpful because there's so much variation from person to person. But what they show is that there are developmental trends or tendencies. Well, okay then, so calling it a disease, how does that actually help? Why not just call it development and then start to study the patterns and see how it changes with time?
That's a really interesting and different way of thinking about it. And it does feel like it would move the field forward quite a bit.
Yeah, I think it is. And, it's happening, this may not surprise you, it's happening more quickly in Europe, for example, in the UK and in Australia than it is in the US. The US is really lagging behind other developed countries in terms of its flexibility or how malleable it is in terms of rethinking the problem of addiction. Now, a lot of that has to do with the impoverished public health system. People don't have the kind of social safety net that is provided by other Western democracies. The way the insurance companies, the way they in many ways control public health policies is extremely unhelpful when it comes to really, trying to make sense of this thing. I mean, the insurance companies are quite happy to call it a disease because then you say, okay, start taking methadone or buprenorphine, and then you're going to be okay, and then we don't have to spend that much money on you. But, that's no way to understand such a complex and problematic phenomenon as addiction. That's just a particular country trying to deal with a pretty distorted healthcare system.
Yes. And if there's one thing that we don't like doing all that much here in America, it's thinking about things in nuance and not in black and white. So,
good point.
Going to make it a little bit tough. Well, Mark, thank you so much for coming on the show. How can people find more of you?
Yeah, well, just go to my website, which is called Understanding Addiction. And the URL is something like I just used the title of my first book, Memoirs of an Addicted Brain.com. So you can look it up that way, or you can look up Understanding Addiction, or you just Google my name and you'll get to it very soon. And on my website, I host a blog, which I think is pretty active, and it's got a terrific readership, a lot of comments, intelligent, insightful comments, not the usual kind of, you know, chatter or mutual criticism. Like, people just don't do that on my blog for some reason. I got lucky, I guess. But
very lucky.
Yeah, I know. With addiction especially, you just get all these people. I mean, one side is trashing AA, and the other side is saying it's the only way, and you know, things just tend to break down. But my blog is really, I say, you know, all modesty, that it's a terrific blog and people should check it out. And I've also got publications and I've got a lot of stuff online on YouTube, TEDx talk, various lectures and talks that you can easily access from my website.
Excellent. And you were recently in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Yeah. That was great. That was kind of my swan song. I think it's about the best I can do in terms of a scientific journal, and I can rest my case now.
All right. That is the cream of the crop there. Well, yeah. Thank you, Mark, so much for joining, and I wish you the best of luck getting this word out, because it feels very, very important.
Thank you, Josh. And thanks for the opportunity to talk to your audience. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's really been a pleasure. Okay. All right. We'll be right back after a couple minutes.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Now there's a book for families who are looking to help loved ones. Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change is now available at Amazon.com, available in hardcover, paperback, and on Kindle. Pick up your copy of Beyond Addiction today. If you are a parent or a partner who is seeking guidance in helping a loved one with substance use, be sure to pick up the 20-Minute Guide. This is a terrific resource, and proceeds help the CMC Foundation for Change. Visit the 20MinuteGuide.com. That's 20MinuteGuide.com. CMC Foundation for Change is a new not-for-profit that is all about families helping families and parents helping parents through addiction from those who have been there. Over 111 million family members worldwide are affected in some way by addiction. CMC Foundation for Change helps give these families hope through support, education, and helpful resources. For more information about CMC Foundation for Change, please visit cmcffc.org on the web. That's cmcffc.org. This is the Beyond Addiction Show. If you have a question or comment about our show, be sure to send an email to beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Again, that's beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. I hope you all enjoyed that interview. I thought it was really good and really helpful and thought-provoking. It really kind of gets you thinking about, all right, we need to do things a little bit better. And especially here in America, where we have so many top scientists, top people, the fact that he's saying, all right, we're behind. Like, I'm out in Europe and they're doing all of this and they're looking at this in a different way and thinking about addiction and thinking about substance use and thinking about the learning model and becoming more nuanced. We're falling behind. And if I was a consumer, if I was on the other end of this saying, gosh, I just heard this, I'd be going into my therapist's office and saying, have you heard about this? And if you haven't, why the hell not? And I insist that you know this, because if I was going into my doctor's office for cancer research, I sure as heck would be saying to people, I need you to know what is out there. And if you're not, if you're still doing like something that's old, that's 15, 25 years old, that is not the the cutting edge research and you don't even know about the cutting edge research, I need you to know that. And it need you to be doing that research. Otherwise, you're not my doctor anymore. Like, simple as that. And so I expect the same kind of service from my mental health professional to be able to say, well, where are you getting that information? And are you up on this other information? Are you up on this newest information? And if you're not, that's a problem. Big, big problem. That's a big problem for me as the consumer, because I want that. I want you as my doctor to know what is the most current, most built up, most thought through science that we have. And that is the... that's just as simple as it gets. That's what I want from my doctors. And I think that the story that he tells about going to boarding school, that's like the piece that really stuck with me. This idea that we're all so individualized that you could go to boarding school and say, oh, that was the best experience of my life. That was the greatest thing ever. I met the best friends. I learned the most about myself. I grew up as a human being. And the person right next to me who had the exact same experience could say, that was the thing that led me to the space where I was at, where I was then using drugs because I needed a way to figure out how to handle all of the emotions that were on me and that were going on and running through me, how I could... handle the difficult situations socially that I'd never really picked up on, that it was too much freedom too early. And that difference is the difference between person A and person B. It is the thing that gets there, that gets you to potentially using substances, and that we need to be thinking about people individually and think about their personal learning experience. Not to say, right, but I loved boarding school, so you should love it. Or I thought that was a great idea, so it should have been a great idea for you too. But rather to have it set up and say, all right, this is you as a human being. This is what you ran into. And right now we need to be thinking about how we help repair and how we help you move forward. Because that's what psychology is. That's what the process of behavior change is to say, all right, there's a lot of different reasons why you got to this point. And now let's figure out what it is that we need to be doing to help get you to the next place. Is it a specific type of treatment? Is it that we have to help work on compulsions? Is it that we have to help work on your trauma? What do we need to be doing to help move you into a forward space, a space that is going to work better for you? And that came really through in what Mark was talking about. And it's not necessarily coming through in all of the treatment that's out there. So I would be going into treatment providers and saying, have you heard of this? Did you hear this podcast? Listen to this guy. Have you heard him talk? Have you bought his books and read through them? Because I have, and I'm the client, and I need you to do that because you are the one who's supposed to be offering me this information. Right? We do more work on picking a car than we do on picking a therapist. We need to become more, you as a consumer, you need to become more of an expert on your own health, on your own choices. So love that interview with Dr. Mark Lewis. And I'm so glad that he was able to come. You know, he was actually on the line. We did this interview a couple of days ago. He did it from France while he's on vacation. I think maybe he was about to go on vacation, or he was wherever he was in the Netherlands or France, 6 hours away, and took the time out to do this. And I really appreciate that he was willing to do that, because it's that important of the information. Next week, Dr. David Fagan talking to us about e-cigarettes. It's like a real bugaboo for me. I think that we are looking at this period of time, and we are going to look back at it at some point and say, what were we thinking? Why in the world did we think that this would be a good idea? And he's here to tell all of us whether or not my thoughts about this are correct or not, and whether or not we should be thinking about e-cigarettes as like, all right, it's really no different, or maybe even worse, I don't know, than regular cigarettes. So we're going to talk to him about that, and about policy and how policy gets passed, and how it can be very difficult to get policy passed. So I'm really looking forward to that one. If you haven't taken the time to go on your podcast app, just go ahead and swipe down, just scroll down that Beyond Addiction Show page till you get to tap to rate 5 stars if you feel like we've earned it. I want to get all the way up there. I want to get up to 100 ratings so that we can start showing up in more people's feeds. So please, please, please take a minute out and rate this show. And if you listen on a different podcasting app, do it there. Till next time, I'm Dr. Josh King. Talk to you soon.
Thank you for joining us this week for the Beyond Addiction Show. Join us again next Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Until the next program, we wish you encouragement and hope.